If we're going to solve our home affordability crisis, we need more homes, millions of them. And to get there, we need a vibrant home building industry. So I'm delighted to be joined on the PolicyCast today by Jim Tobin, the Chief Executive Officer of the National Association of Home Builders. Jim took over as CEO this past June after many years as its chief lobbyist. He leads an organization of 140,000 members and oversees a staff of 200. He and his association have to navigate tricky waters, including high interest rates, land use restrictions, and growing regulatory costs to meet consumer demand for more homes. Let's see how he plans to do that. Well, Jim, thank you very much for agreeing to join me today on the Arch Mortgage Insurance PolicyCast.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, Kirk. It's really fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, you know, in one sense, this might be considered the heyday for home building. You can't read an article anymore without seeing the dire need for additional housing stock. And you guys are making progress. I saw that you completed about 1.5 million homes in 2023. It's the highest since 2007. But, you know, the industry still... it still faces a laundry list of challenges going forward. We're going to have a chance to talk about some of those issues, but I thought I would just start off with the first one of, how's it going in the transition from being the chief advocacy officer for the NAHB to the chief executive officer?
Yeah, it's great. So it's been since June 1, so I guess 9 months in or whatever the right number is. Number one, it's been a lot of fun, which is what you want to hear. When you're changing jobs, but more importantly, I think the response by our officer team, our five elected builder officers, as well as the membership at large, has been very, very positive. And that's always the change or the chance that maybe they still look at you as the 27-year-old kid that you joined way back when. But they haven't. They've really embraced me as the CEO and really give me an opportunity to try to do some things differently and just make some changes and really kind of evolve NHB as a company, but also try to move the association forward and really lean into what I think is going to be a pretty darn good few years, at least for home building and making sure we're prepared for that.
Well, it's certainly going to be a challenging next couple of years. And you know, we need millions of more in housing units, single family and multi-housing together. And the millennials, our largest generation, have entered the traditional home buying years. How are home buyers or home builders responding to this challenge?
Well, they're ready to meet it. And, you know, with the high interest rate environment and so many people rate locked. I mean, that's really the story of kind of the post-COVID recovery. Even though home building was one of, if not the only industry that seemed to defy the COVID gravity of the larger economy, you know, we really boomed in 2020 and 2021. You know, 22 inflation caught up with us, and obviously 23. We felt the full bite of the Fed's actions in interest rates and moving up close to 8%, which has kept that existing home market really locked up. And if you're a new home buyer or first generational buyer, you traditionally go into the existing market. Well, that really hasn't been available. We haven't seen the baby boomers moving out as much yet. Again, same issues. So in a strange way, 2023 saw new home construction as an outsized portion of the for sale market, because it really was the only game in town. Usually for sale homes are about, you know, on your monthly sales numbers, they're about 10%, 12%, maybe. We saw them up of, you know, 30%. So for us, the members were still very busy, but you know, at a slower pace, of course, as you would imagine, interest rates still were tough. But if you were a creditworthy borrower, and you had a down payment, you were looking at new construction more probably than you ever had before. So we're ready to go. It's just, if we could get some of these headwinds out of the way, we'll meet that demand.
So you mentioned the fact that a lot of home owners are staying in their home because of what they have very low interest rates, while the economy now we're seeing higher interest rates. How have builders been able to attract new buyers in this higher interest rate environment?
Well, there's a couple ways. One, that just price reductions, which obviously, the cost of construction is as high as it is, whether it's government regulations or building materials or land costs, so reducing prices to try to stay competitive, or we're seeing rate buydowns. A lot of our builders have really leaned into rate buydowns to get people out of those, sevens, but now we're kind of firmly in the 6% range for mortgages, trying to buy them down into the low sixes or even into the high fives. That's really been a very good tool for builders. And as rates have started to come down, we're seeing that less and less in our surveys. But it was pretty high. 30 or 40% of our surveyed builders were offering some incentives, whether again it was price or buy downs to get people into homes.
So you mentioned the first-time home buyer increasingly facing long odds to get any house. Generally, they want a smaller home, but by and large, entry-level homes aren't particularly profitable for your builders. So they aren't being constructed in huge numbers. Walk us through some of the reasons for that.
Well, I think number one, you're talking about just the cost to build a home. About 23% of the cost of a single family unit is directly attributable to government regulation at all three levels of government: local, state, and national. And so that's that regulatory stack that I think is really the impediment to building an affordable product. So first you have the land development process, not only finding land, but then getting it through the entitlement process. That takes a while. Then actually improving the land, and then building a structure on it. All those stops along the way require going for plan approvals. And local governments move slowly, some faster than others, but generally not as fast as the speed of money. And so that, and if the builders are having those carrying costs, that slows the process down. So that's number one. Number two, then you'll get material costs. Some are still stubbornly high. We talk a lot about lumber prices in NAHB, because that's one of the biggest so materials pieces that go into a home. But while those are low, we've seen other material costs take a little bit longer. One of the issues we're fighting now is distributional transformers, those big electrical boxes that sit at the foot of subdivisions that power homes. Those are on, a year and a half delay. So that's part of the delay process. And then labor. We have a persistent skilled labor shortage in the construction industry, month after month, year after year, now a decade, of about 400,000 job shortage. So labor's tight, which means when labor's tight, labor's more expensive. And that all adds to the how hard it is to build that entry-level home, that $350,000 or $400,000 home. And if you're from California, if you can find a $300,000 home, it's like finding that beautiful cheap wine that everybody seeks. But that's the real challenge. It's just this kind of, one after another. Those are the headwinds I talked about.
So actually, to solve that problem, really small homes in Oregon and Texas, anywhere from 400 to 600 square feet, were recently featured in a New York Times article. And I wonder, might this become a trend, or do you think it's just kind of an outlier?
I think while we have seen home size trend lower over the last several years, down from 2,400 square feet to 2,100 or 2,200 square feet, I still think people now, and I think that what we have seen in the surveys of millennial buyers, you talked about that large cohort that's moving into their prime home buying years. They're not looking for a starter home, and then in 5 or 10 years from now into their move up home, they're looking kind of to buy the one home they're going to stay in now. So that means they're going to want that little extra room. And while there certainly is a space for those smaller homes, again, because it's clearly an affordability issue. What we are seeing is that, I don't want to call them their forever homes, but they're not in them for that 7 to 10 year range. They're looking to stay in there longer, which means they're going to want a little bigger home so that their family, they choose to have one, can grow into that house.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on some of the regulatory obstacles that the builders are commonly encountering, and what is NAHB doing to streamline or mitigate some of those concerns?
Well, we work with our local home builders associations. We're a federation of over 600 state and local associations. So we work very closely with them to find ways to streamline the permitting process, right? So many local governments have 17 different departments you got to stop through from implementation phase all the way to the end. You're trying to streamline that because every bureaucrat at the local level wants a little taste, and they want to make sure that they're important in the process, and they all are. But maybe we can find a way to streamline that, or maybe we can find a way to, if you check all of the boxes in a community for what they want a development to look like or a home to look like, it's something called by right development, that if you check all the boxes, your plan is automatically approved. Those are things that are important. Again, just the time it takes, if time is money. So if we can reduce the time that it takes, making land more available, that's really the one of the things we're going to face over the next several years is lot availability, is developable land. Lord knows we've got plenty of it in the country. We just have to unlock it and have a willingness for growth. And especially these communities that are trying to attract, businesses into their communities. I think of Columbus, Ohio, and the big Intel chip factory. Housing has to be part of those equations. So local governments really have to make sure that they are putting housing into their economic development equation. And then, the last one I'll talk about when it comes to some of the regulatory headwinds is permitting. Again, moving things faster, and really government being a partner with a builder who's looking to add more supply. That's really what it's going to take in order to put more supply in the marketplace.
Jim, you know, and I know, if you talk to Republicans on Capitol Hill, if you talk to Democrats on Capitol Hill, everyone agrees that home ownership is a worthy good and that we need more houses. In one of its very final reports, the Trump administration, when it left office in 2021, advocated for eliminating regulatory barriers to affordable housing. Within the first 6 months of the Biden administration, they created a report with the exact same goal in its Housing Supply Action Plan. Land use regulations really ranked among the very top obstacles that both of these white papers addressed. And I'm wondering, just from your vantage point, what should be the role of the federal government in trying to lower land use barriers?
Yeah, I think it's the federal permitting process is really critical, and there's an alphabet soup of laws, but one we interact with a lot is the Clean Water Act and the necessity of draining or filling land to make it more developable. You have the NEPA is another one of these. That's really big. Kind of think about big transportation, moving large areas of dirt. But anything you can do to get the federal permitting process out of the way. We interact with so many different agencies, with EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers, when I talk about the Clean Water Act, but the Bureau of Interior, whether it's, and when it comes to Native American lands as well, there's a lot of stops along the way. It's really trying to just speed that up, because at the end of the day, local land use laws are really where the rubber hits the road. But there is this federal overlay to make sure that, we talk about the federal safety net, and we get it. We all want clean air and clean water. It's vital to, just as us as humans, but just to the economic prosperity of the country. But there's got to be a way to balance economic growth with the need for environmental protection. And that's really critical. So that's where the federal government can be helpful. I think another area, I talked about workforce development earlier, getting lawmakers, especially the president, talk about the trades as a viable career, not just a job, not just plan B if you can't make it in college, but that the trades are really a plan A and a great career. Lord knows if any of your listeners have had to use a plumber or any kind of one of the trades in your home, how much they charge and how scarce they are. So those are some of the things that the federal government can use their bully pulpit, and especially leaning into local governments to get out of the way, finding incentives, whether it's transportation dollars that can flow as an incentive, but also tied to lowering those regulatory barriers at the local level when it comes to housing production.
Let me follow up a little bit on the labor question. You had mentioned earlier there's about 400,000 construction jobs that are going wanting right now for a variety of reasons, and it's kind of been this way, at least trending this way, ever since the crash of the OOTs. What steps are you trying to take as an industry to address the labor shortage? And what role might immigration reform play in solving it?
Yeah, perfect. Thanks for teaming me up on immigration reform. So I look at workforce as a coin, and one side is what I'll call, you know, training our domestic workforce. So that means that goes back to what I said about getting more people interested in the trades and reminding them that you can be successful, highly successful in America without going to college. And so getting more kids in the trades, the average age of a contractor now is about 56 or 57 years old. So our contractors are getting older. We've got to replenish that labor supply with young kids interested in getting in the trades, leaning into at-risk youth, or even training behind the prison walls, and helping people get a job and a skill if they are incarcerated, and then when they re-enter society, finding them good paying jobs. We have a workforce development partner called the Home Builders Institute. They are vital in training. They're actually the number one contractor for the Department of Labor's Job Corps program. Trading at-risk youth across in Job Corps centers across the country. So really leaning into finding the new workforce by talking to kids and getting them involved in the trades. The other side, you mentioned it, is immigration reform. The other side of that coin, about 23% of construction labor in this country, now not just home building, but construction at large, is immigrant labor. And so we have got to recognize that we have a broken immigration system, and that we need comprehensive reform that goes from the border, securing the border, and allowing people who want to work in this country to come through the border safely and legally, and then all the way up to solving the problem of the 12 or 13 million undocumented people in this country, getting them out of the shadows, and people call it amnesty, people call it permanent green cards, stand at the end of the longest line, pay a fine, whatever that solution is. But we have got We've got to recognize that is as much part of the equation. And then there's stops along the middle. We believe in an employment system that allows employers to go to a federal database to find the work eligibility of an immigrant laborer, and one that works for employers as well. And then the last piece I'll just mention is, we would like to have a visa for construction labor. There's visas for high tech, there's visa for seasonal workers or ag workers, one for construction would be great too. So we're pushing all of those, but immigration reform is absolutely part of the solution when it comes to our labor issues.
Well, thanks. Jim, your members don't just do new construction. They do a lot of renovation work as well. And in many cities, we have housing stocks that's aging, it's often too dilapidated, too dangerous to live in. What should policymakers be doing to make those houses viable again?
Yeah, again, it comes down, there's a lot of lead paint. If it was before the 1970s, probably has lead paint in it. So how do you abate lead paint? There's a lot of laws where the federal government does interact when it comes to those larger scale projects, that finding ways to make it easier to make those repairs. And those remodels, that's a huge piece. Remodeling is going to be a big part of the sector moving forward. People age in place. There is that older housing stock. People have seen some of their equity rise. So maybe rather than moving in this high interest rate space, they're going to remodel their homes and make it more livable for the long term. But the government should just encourage remodeling as another way to extend the lives of our homes. We're going to, like you said at the top, that we're built about 1.5 million units in 2023. That's single and multifamily. We'll build a little bit less than that or less than that in 2023 or 2024. But that just means, so that means there's about 130, 135 million homes that were built before this year. And most of them before 2000. I live in a home that was built in 1985. Those homes need to be remodeled. They're certainly not at the end of their useful life. So that's why there's a real burgeoning market out there for remodeling, and we think that we're pretty bullish on that in the future as well.
Let's focus a moment on energy code requirements. NAHB has some grave reservations about recommendations that were found in the International Energy Conservation Code related to home building, largely due, I think, to affordability issues. How does NAHB view the balance between meeting housing demand and adhering to some sustainable building practices?
Yeah, our members today are building the most energy efficient and resilient home ever built. Full stop. There is the home that we build today is more efficient than the home we built 3 years ago. And 3 years from now, that home is going to be more efficient than the home today. The idea that somehow we are not as efficient as people want, and there's a real zeal to move to net zero as quickly as possible. Net zero is very, very expensive. And my feeling, and I say this for my members as well, the idea that we can save someone $10 or $15 a month on their energy bills, but the house is going to cost $10,000 or $15,000 more to purchase, that is not a recipe to get those first-time or first-generational home buyers in the marketplace, because the payback is so long that it's just not worth it. Then they're going to, so what does that mean? Rather than buying a new, highly energy efficient home, you're going to go look for an existing home that is not as energy efficient. The windows haven't been upgraded. There's not a lot of insulation in the attic. That's what we're doing. So there's has to be a balance between moving the code steadily forward to more energy efficiency while keeping affordability, because there are some things that just don't make any sense. You know, I'll give you an example. You talk about the upcoming code. There is an effort to put in the energy efficiency code, not the structural code, the energy efficiency code, the mandatory EV chargers. It sounds like a great idea, right? Well, what if you're never going to buy an EV? So now you're paying for an EV charger you're never going to use. And the real question is that, does an EV charger, is that part of the energy efficiency package of a home? It's not. That's part of the energy efficient package for your car. But that's not going to add one dime of savings to your energy bill, but it is going to add cost to that house. And so those are the things that should be in the structural code. Let's have a conversation about that. That's the push and pull of energy codes right now, is really balancing out affordability. Personally, I think affordability has been thrown out the window again for the zeal of let's make every new home in America the most efficient home it can be. We're going to build 900,000 new homes this year. How about we retrofit the 130 million homes that were built before 2000? If you care about energy efficiency and housing, older homes are the only place you're going to really squeeze that energy from.
That's a good point. How is technology changing the way builders are constructing homes? And kind of a follow-on to that is house technology changing what home buyers expect to see in a new home?
Yeah, I think people want fun tech. You think about when the first programmable thermostats came out, what, 15 or 20 years ago? Ooh, that was great. Now you do it from your phone. People want a smarter home. They want, you know, we just came back from our international builder show last week. I saw all the best, the biggest, the best, and the latest and greatest when it comes to building products. But we're looking at, you know, AI is going to be out there when it comes to housing. We saw, you know, there's faucets that monitor your water usage, so you can keep an eye on your water consumption. Certainly, you're going to see smarter units where they turn a light off when you're not in a room, and as soon as you walk in, they turn it on. You know, again, heating and cooling, really trying to squeeze that efficiency out of those units and in usage. You know, TVs, you know, the big appliances, they're getting more energy efficient, and that's all tech related, right? How do you wash a load of clothes with a cup and a half of water and have them still come clean rather than gallons of water like we had when we were kids? So those things are really important, and people want to be on that cutting edge. And you know, I think about my cell phone, how cutting that edge that is. People want to see that in your home, so we're seeing that get incorporated into the future, and I think that's really important. And I'll just one other piece on tech: we're seeing advances in home construction because we need to combat that lack of labor. So you're looking at it, you know, trusses are now built offsite, trucked over to a house and put up with a crane rather than being built by hand like we used to do. We're watching, there's a, there's even a, the future has a bricklaying machine, that would take a place of bricklayers. I don't think that's ever really going to happen. But 3D printed homes, there's all kinds of ways, more offsite construction when it comes to panelization, where you bring four walls in, you bolt them together, again, less labor, and which makes the cost a little bit more affordable. So there's a lot of innovation in housing. Again, if you remember, we're an industry that up until a few years ago, the greatest technological advance was the nail gun. So you can see, but we are getting ready to make some big leaps in home construction.
Jim, the last question is if there's three things that either federal or local government could do to really make the job easier of expanding our housing stock, what would they be?
So number one, make land more available. Give opportunities for developers and builders to access more land. The more land that's out there, the less expensive it is. And land is one of, if not the biggest component to a home home price. Making land more affordable and available is number one. Number two, I would have to say that we have got to find a way to move that permitting process faster. Let's get more homes on the market faster. Again, time is money, and that equals a less expensive home. And then finally, I think just leaning into the need for more supply. So many times, local lawmakers have the NIMBY mindset. Not in my backyard. People who say, I've got mine, I don't want anybody to have theirs. And they throw up a whole bunch of different roadblocks, parking restrictions, traffic, all of these different things. More courageous lawmakers to look at people and say, we want a growing, vibrant community. We want our kids to be able to live here instead of having to move out. We want our firefighters, our nurses, our police women to stay in the communities that they serve, and housing affordability is part of that. A more vibrant community. That's what we really need out there, like courage to say out loud, we're going to build more housing in our community. Those are the three things that I would say that we would want people to really lean into, and just know that the only way we're going to solve the housing affordability crisis in this country is by building more homes, putting more supply in the market, not incentivizing an already expensive product. There is no point in taking a home that costs $700,000 and say, hey, we're going to give you a little money to afford that. Why don't we drop that home price down to $500,000 so people can afford it? That's really what it is. It's supply. To paraphrase James Carville from his days with Bill Clinton, who said it's the economy stupid, it's supply stupid. That's what we have to do to solve home price creep in this country.
Jim, you've been a great interview. Yeah. Thanks for taking the time with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Curry. This is great. Thanks.